The title of today's program on Inside the Black Box is A New Bag of Chips. I thought about, what was the movie? Something Mr. Chips, Goodbye Mr. Chips?
Goodbye Mr. Chips.
Okay. And New Bag of Chips is actually an update, right? It's an update on, I don't know what the last one was, where Cliff Henderson, our guest today, talked about the latest developments in processing semiconductors. Was that a reasonable description of what we did last time?
I think that's pretty close, Pete.
Right, and things have changed since then.
They're always changing. For the last 60 years, if they didn't, we wouldn't have that great new cell phone in your pocket.
Right, exactly. So will we be bumping into the end of Moore's Law anytime soon?
We certainly hope not, but that's always the specter looming over the horizon.
All right, but that's what we'll talk about, the specter of Moore's Law. And then probably in a few weeks, we're going to get some guys in here to talk about quantum computing. Does that worry you? Are you worried about quantum?
No, I mean, obviously, I think we take all the best available technology. Well, you know, I mean, ultimately, there are fabrication challenges, and that's where we tend to work in that space, no matter what the device is. And certainly, there will be new devices required as we go down the road. You know, the days of the planar silicon transistor are already over in some sense. And so we're already moving on to other devices. So
all to make a new chip for your cell phone.
So,
a new bag of chips. Next up on Inside the Black Box. Science, only funnier.
Do you like ska, reggae, dub without the step? Tune into 5446 Thursdays at 8 p.m. right here on WREK Atlanta 91.1 The Laser or online at WREK.org. DJ Scoot and the Tonics have the best selection of old school, two-tone, and third-wave wax around. Once again, that's 5446 right here on 91.1 FM Thursdays at 8 p.m.
Get your weekly dose of the blues here on the Friday Night Fish Fry, Fridays from 6 to 8. Hear both new local acts and blues classics as we pull them off the streets and out of the archives, and get your weekend lineup of shows every Friday at 7. That's the Friday Night Fish Fry from 6 to 8 here on WRK Atlanta, 91.1 FM.
All your love, I'm just a love rain. All your kiss, I'm just kissing.
The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology. Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science, only funnier. I'm Pete Ludovis, and today I'm joined by my guest, Cliff Henderson, to discuss today's topic, a new bag of chips. And by chips, we mean semiconductors. Do they still call them chips? Everybody calls it chip.
Everybody still calls it a chip, usually.
I mean, lab on a chip. So it's really a chip of silicon that has all sorts of patterning on it to create transistors and other, what do they call the non-transistors? Passives? Do they still call them that?
Right.
So resistors, capacitors?
Right. Transistors, resistors, capacitors, inductors, all sorts of things that make up the device. But and by the way, be careful. It's not all silicon anymore either. It's a strange new world out there.
Well, I know it's doped with all sorts of stuff and layered, but isn't the basis still silicon?
You can even find compound semiconductors creeping their way into devices you'll buy for very, very high-speed electronics.
Oh, okay. So Cliff Henderson is a professor of chemical and biomolecular engineering here at Georgia Tech. Did his bachelor's degree right here at Georgia Tech, right?
That's correct.
Is it weird coming back? Is it?
It is a bit interesting seeing it from sort of all sides.
And I mean, now that you see it from the other side, as a student, were you thinking, well, the faculty must be crazy, and now you've confirmed that?
I don't know about that, but, you know, I certainly, I think, have a good appreciation for what the students go through. So I try and, you know, take that firsthand knowledge back with me to the classroom.
You do. And in fact, when you're sitting in faculty meetings, you try to represent the students' view.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think in general, the faculty have the students' best interests at heart, even though it may not always seem that way.
Yes. Okay, I would agree with that. Then you went on to do your master's and PhD at University of Texas, Austin. That was in chemical engineering, right?
That's correct.
Even though it was with Grant Wilson, my former boss's boss at IBM, who's really a chemist, right?
That's right. Yeah, it's a small world, right? You and I have that connection, but that's right. So our group was actually joint, both in chemistry and chemical engineering. So we had about 50% of the group were chemists. Right. And 50% were chemical engineers.
And much of what Cliff works on is polymeric stuff. So he'll look at ultra-thin films for various applications. One of those applications is in semiconductor patterning. You also look at graphene and graphene devices, which we talked about on the show last year, which, of course, garnered the Nobel Prize. I think it was 2 years ago?
It's a couple years ago now. Right.
And this underscores something we've talked about on the program a number of times, and that is the collaborative interdisciplinary nature of things. So you may be a chemical engineer who works for a chemist who ends up in a chemical engineering department who does things you normally think of as associated with electrical engineers and electronics, when in fact most semiconductor processing is very interdisciplinary, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the common misconception that a lot of people have, even some of our own chemical engineering undergraduate students, probably when they first come in, is that, you know, if you talk about semiconductors, that, well, that must mainly be electrical engineers.
Right.
And the answer is that's far from being the case. Certainly on the device design side, that's a very heavily electrical engineering driven aspect of the business.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to actually manufacturing semiconductors, that is very much a chemie problem.
And
a very large number of chemical engineers are actually employed by the semiconductor industry in the manufacturing side of the operation.
Right. And obviously, a lot of that manufacturing, and particularly development, will involve chemists, material scientists, physicists, all sorts of folks that deal with both the materials and then how we optically and thermally process these sorts of things.
Right. Certainly, if you look at the research and development end, it's a whole smorgasbord of different degrees that end up collaborating together to continue to advance the industry. On the manufacturing side, though, we're basically in the trenches making wafers. It's actually, in large part, a lot of chemical engineers. And, you know, I mean, if you had to pick an engineering major that, you know, is as large, if not larger, than the electrical engineering majors that are actually in semiconductor fabs making wafers, chemies would be that one.
All right. So before we get into the details of the new developments in making these chips, let's begin, as we often do, with
Science in the News.
And today's Science in the News actually comes from, this Tuesday, Science Time in the New York Times, an article called "A Chemist Comes Very Close to the Midas Touch" by Hillary Rosner in the New York Times. She discusses a lab in Princeton University's ultra-sleek chemistry building where researchers toil in a modern-day hunt for the elusive power, alchemy. All right, this scares the crap out of me, because when you think of alchemy, it's like, oh, we're going to make gold out of iron and stuff like that. It's a nice little, literary device to use. It's a nice opening. But in fact, what they're dealing with is Professor Chirik, a chemistry professor at Princeton, who's managed a new twist on a time-worn pursuit. Namely, not to get iron into gold, but to get iron to behave as catalysts like really expensive metals, gold, platinum. Now there are things like yttrium, erbium, you know, all these weird elements that you don't think of as something you'd make jewelry out of, but are actually as or more expensive than gold because they're very rare. Strategically, this is important because actually China's got a lot of these rare metals, more so than we do. And the reason you use metals for catalysts is very simple. The way organic molecules, like polymers that you might be making in the semiconductor industry or something like that, bond to them is via a very weak bond called a coordination bond. And what they do is they bond to this, and it's very weak. And then they undergo a reaction, and the purpose of the catalyst is to reduce the energy barrier to getting to the products. And it does that by bonding there, changing the electronic state. But it has to be a weak bond, because then it has to unbond and the product needs to go away, and another reactant needs to bond. So metals are really good. There are two ways to control catalytic reactions. Use different metals under different conditions, or now what they do is they take some organic molecules and bind them to the various sites. Most of these metals can bind more than one thing, 2, 4, 8, even more different, we call them ligands. And by changing the ligands or the ligand field with different organic compounds, you find that you can change the electronic structure of less expensive metals, you know, iron or cobalt, and make them work more like, you know, palladium, platinum, gold, or these weird elements like erbium. And in fact, that's exactly what Professor Chirik's work is doing. And keep in mind that much of the reactions you use, right, we use chemicals that are in our consumer products. We use polymers that create all the containers to hold those consumer products. Most of those use a catalyst, and those metals are typically and they're typically metals. And the interesting thing about it is Professor Chirik works in what's called homogeneous catalysis. That means it's floating around in the reaction mixture and you lose it, right? It goes out with the product. It's a very, very small amount. But the article reminds us that we actually use expensive platinum catalysts in dyeing blue jeans. So your blue jeans have a tiny bit of these very expensive metals. So the degree that we can make it work with iron will transform products you see every single day. So modern-day alchemy, there it is. And then, Cliff, you were mentioning to me something else in the news. Did you find that guy?
I did. I mentioned the 24-mile-high jump by Felix Baumgartner here the last few days.
And you were complaining that it wasn't really covered by a major news outlet.
Yeah, it actually received, I think, relatively little attention here in the U.S. in terms of conventional news media, but certainly made quite the splash on the internet now, which I think is a little unfortunate. It's one of those science events that could, you know, get kids excited about science and engineering.
Ah, so there's the value, right? Yeah. I mean, as boring as catalysts are, being able to make things without expensive metals reduces the cost. Very, very important application. And I'm wondering, what is the application if some guy jumping from, how high was it?
24 miles up.
24 miles without bursting into flames. Because he did break the sound barrier.
He did. He was actually the first human to break the sound barrier without a plane being surrounded.
Now, the nice thing is, at the point at which he broke the sound barrier, there wasn't enough air around him to really cause a problem.
Right. I mean, so he didn't have any, you know, nasty physical effects from the shockwave or anything. In fact, I guess his suit was so well designed, you couldn't even really tell that the shockwave had occurred.
Oh, okay. Okay. So so my question then is, well, maybe the reason they didn't cover it is, who cares?
Well, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's certainly, it's
you
one
see
of those
is an outreach thing?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's interesting from a number of different points of view. One is that it was, you know, completely done by, again, sort of private industry, right? So Red Bull, of all people, actually sponsored this activity.
Seems appropriate.
Maybe. You know, they tend to sponsor some of these daredevilish type activities. But, you know, in this particular case, they put the guy basically into space and had him jump out of there. So, you know, from the wow factor, there's a big wow factor there. You know, but from the more practical side, you know, for example, NASA is very interested in what they've done now, as it turns out, because essentially, you know, they've had a problem for years that what if during, you know, takeoff, they have a problem and you need to evacuate
the
spacecraft. Can you do that
good
from
point.
High altitude? And so, of course, he has a spacesuit that's designed to allow him to jump and actually then parachute into the ground from 24 miles up, which is pretty far out there. So. So there are some, you know, so there are some direct applications for what he's doing. And then, you know, there's a whole bunch of spin-off things. So, you know, some of the materials that were developed to build parts of the suit and the balloon that, you know, takes them up to 24 miles, which alone is quite the engineering feat. You know, so imagine something about the thickness of your dry cleaning bag.
Yeah, that's actually what they look like when they start inflating.
That's right. So they're actually fairly fragile. That inflates to something like 55 stories tall that carries you far into the outer atmosphere.
So yet another example of NASA's wow factor and the development, not so much science, but real engineering of materials, right? I mean, Velcro and things like that have come from the space program, and here's another example. So
yeah, although this one was, again, you know, the big difference is this was not part of a governmental-led agency effort.
Right. Private science doing the job.
Private science.
All right. So Semiconductors. Maybe we should do a quick review. How do they make these chips?
Well, actually, I want to tie back into a point you just made, though, in your science in the news.
I actually made a point? You're kidding.
You did, yeah.
Please,
talking about, you know, replacing expensive metals. I mean, you know, that's a common problem, not just in catalysis, but in lots of different areas. And certainly there are semiconductor applications there as well. So one of the big ones on the side of the world that I tend to work on is in displays, for example. So all of us have now come to enjoy all of the 50, 60-inch flat-screen TVs and, you know, 30-inch monitors and all these sorts of things. And all of those tend to have indium tin oxide as a transparent conducting electrode that actually is used.
And I'm guessing it's the indium, not the tin, that's the economically limiting step.
Indium is, as it turns out, both quite scarce and now also quite expensive. So, you know, at the current rate of utilization, I mean, there are different people's forecasts. It's not just a cost problem. It is that, in principle, there's some speculation that we could run out of the available indium supply in something like only maybe a couple decades. So much like other natural resources, you can actually potentially expend that one. And right now, of course, the challenge is that people don't have an equivalently good alternative transparent conductor. And of course, you need to be able to see through it if it's going to be something that you're building a screen out of.
Right.
And so that's a big search, is how to develop new materials, for example, in that space, which replace indium, which also can be a good conductor and be transparent. So it's, you know, that's a common problem, actually trying to replace these high-value materials, either due to scarcity or price or both. So it's a common material science and engineering problem. Certainly, we
are there any candidates coming down the pipe on this one?
Well, as it turns out, one of the things you mentioned earlier, graphene. So that's one that's certainly being looked at. You know, basically, an atomically thin carbon sheet has great conducting properties in principle, and of course is quite transparent if you really have it as a one carbon atom layer thickness. So, so that's certainly being looked at. But there are other, you know, exotic oxides and things being looked at as well, which also tend to be good current conductors. So the search is on. There's no, I think, established solution yet, but certainly a fruitful area to work in.
Right. So when you think of metal oxides, a lot of metal oxides are relatively transparent because they're amorphous, right?
Right.
So silicon oxide window pane glass is basically that. But by changing the metals, what you're saying is we also get electrical conductivity.
Yeah, most people think of an oxide, you know, as you mentioned, like a window glass, as being a non-conductor. But certainly there are cases where you can find quite good conductivity. Not metallic, but you know, close.
Right. And with regard to graphene, I mean, most people think of graphene. Graphene's the idealized sort of perfect version of graphite.
That's right. So take a single layer of the graphite lattice off and use it just as a single
sheet.
And
that is transparent. Whereas graphite, big absorber, very, very black, imperfect. You now are involved in Cub Scouts, right?
I am involved
in
Cub
Scouts. Are you a big graphite fan now? Have you done the Pinewood Derby yet?
I have not had the pleasure of using graphite as a way to make the wheels spin.
And your kids get the graphite all over them. It's just horrible.
Yeah, I can only imagine. So,
all right, there it is. Flat planar carbon useful for Pinewood Derbies or, in the appropriate state, maybe a replacement for indium tin oxide.
That's right.
All right. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about chips, right?
Absolutely.
And how they're made, and then what the new developments are in processing semiconductors. And again, if you've got a question or comment about this fascinating topic, which ought to be fascinating because it affects every piece of electronics you put on a holder connected to your belt, and you're listening to us live Wednesdays noon to 1, by all means, give us a call here at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
The following is a public service announcement brought to you by the staff of WREK Atlanta. Does your family have a plan in the event of an emergency? Emergencies are almost always unexpected, so many people are caught unprepared when they happen. Don't let this happen to you. Take the time to talk to your family about creating an emergency plan. Talk about things like where to meet, who would pick up the kids, and what supplies you should have. Go to ready.gov for more information on getting prepared for any emergency. This message was brought to you by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Ad Council.
Hey, Amit, we got to do a new promo.
Ah, that time of year.
You can choose the music, though. What would you like to hear?
Something with cake.
New Seeing Cake just came in.
That sounds awesome. Thrill Jockey.
All right, let me pull that up.
Lost in the Stacks is the one and only research library rock and roll radio show. Each Friday at noon, Amit and Charlie from the Georgia Tech Library pick a theme and free associate an hour of music, interviews, and library talk.
You'll hear indie rock, pop rock, alt rock, new wave, and the occasional oddity that one of us pulls out of the vault in between interviews with students, faculty, and librarians.
That's Lost in the Stacks on WREK Atlanta every Friday at noon right here on 91.1 FM.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're discussing making semiconductors with Cliff Henderson from the School of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering and semiconductor guru extraordinaire, who's here with a very dapper sweater. Are you playing golf later? Is that why you got the sweater on?
No, I only wish.
You must be meeting with somebody important, because you don't dress like that for
no,
us.
No, it was like 40 degrees when I got up this morning, so it was purely motivated by just trying to be warm.
Oh, but you got it's a matched Argyle look. You look like a captain of industry. That's all I'm saying. All right, so how are we making these chips?
Well, the overall process, if you looked at it from a 10,000-foot point of view, hasn't really changed, probably on its surface much in the last, 50 or 60 years since essentially integrated circuit manufacturing was started. Mm-hmm. So there are still four basic processes. You basically end up starting out pretty much every cycle by cleaning things just rigorously down to atomically clean levels. You then typically go through a second step, which often involves depositing a material, so conductors or insulators that you're going to use to build up the device. Typically, most of those processes deposit those materials as continuous films over the substrate. And as you mentioned earlier, the most common substrate is silicon still.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you don't tend to want that material as a continuous film. And so one has to then actually go back and carve out of that the structures you really want. So, for example, metal wiring to connect together various transistors. So that's done in the third step, the lithographic step that you mentioned. That's the mm-hmm. area we tend to work a lot in, or the patterning step.
Right.
And so the idea there is we put down a material, usually polymeric in nature, that does the three-dimensional equivalent of what you do when you use film in your camera, right? So we basically do the inverse of that. We take an image of what we want to manufacture, so basically like a film negative,
mm-hmm.
and we project that back onto these photoresist layers and create a three-dimensional structured pattern from that image. And that serves as a protective mask that lets us basically etch away or carve away the film material that was deposited in that mm-hmm. second step that we don't want. And that etching is done in that sort of fourth step. So we basically do those four steps over and over again. So we clean things, we deposit material, we put down a patterning layer on that material, and we etch it. And you repeat that entire cycle on the order of 70 or 80 times these days. So on the order mm-hmm. of maybe 300 individual process steps. And out the other end, starting from a silicon wafer, you get, an Intel microprocessor or whoever is making the chip.
Right. And it's because of those hundreds of processes that, in my comedy act, I sometimes make fun of statistical things like Six Sigma.
Right.
But Six Sigma, where you actually try to get your sigma, your standard deviation, so small that plus or minus Six Sigma, even though it's not exactly Six Sigma, if you look at the way they do these things, is actually within the appropriate constraints and is a functional device.
Right.
If you're making, plastic tubs, laundry baskets, things like that, Six Sigma is probably not a cost-effective way to go. But with your processes, right, you do want to make your probability of failure so small because you get to repeat it hundreds of times.
Yeah, you can do the math quite simply, right? So if you have 300 individual steps to, let's say, make a device,
right,
and you're successful to 99% of all the things you make on each step are correct and function, how many devices would you have at the end of the day that still work? And so raise 0.99 to the 300th power, and what you'll find out very quickly is that 99% success is not good enough.
Yeah, exactly.
And so you really need to have extraordinarily good precision and repeatability to make a functioning device. Otherwise, you go out of business.
Uh-huh.
So Six Sigma, as you mentioned, all of the early work in that was really actually driven and motivated in the semiconductor industry.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't know that.
That's right.
Because it belongs in the semiconductor
industry.
That's
right. It's an integral part of the way they do business.
Right. Absolutely. And it's because of the multi-step process.
That's right.
So, for example, these polymeric films that you're talking about, you spread one of these things down, and then what you can do is you can remove part of it, and other parts leave it there. And then when you go and etch, the part with no polymer film gets etched more than the part that's got the polymer film on it. It protects it for a while. So you can then pattern whatever's underneath it like silicon. And basically what you do is you need to transfer that pattern. And if you make the polymer such that when you shine light on it, it either becomes soluble or insoluble, and then you wash it away, right? Is that basically how you pattern these things?
Yeah. So it's, you know, like in photographic film, it's called a development process.
Right.
Except in our particular case, instead of developing a color in the image, here we actually develop a relief structure or a topography on the surface.
Right.
And as you mentioned, it's by selectively dissolving parts of the film away. Mm-hmm. So... and that change in solubility that lets us to selectively dissolve the material is induced right now using UV light that's pattern-wise exposed onto the film.
And then with regard to what's being developed in terms of better ways to make this stuff, is it fair to say smaller? Is that the driving force in this industry?
Certainly making things smaller is still a big driver. Historically, being able to make structures, in particular individual transistors, smaller, you know, the question is, why is that such a powerful thing? That's a question I get actually fairly commonly. The answer historically has been for two reasons. One, that as you make a transistor smaller, that means that the gate, the width between the source and the drain where the electrons and holes start and end their travel, that distance gets shorter. And sort of in simplistic terms, as that distance gets shorter, that means that the time it takes an electron or hole to cross that region actually gets shorter in time,
mm-hmm.
which translates into you can switch it faster. And so we all sort of think of, a lot of times these days people hear, you know, oh, it's a 3.4 gigahertz device or something these days. Mm-hmm. And they don't really think about what that means. But that's really telling you about essentially the clock frequency or how fast things are switching.
Right, that you can switch through many thousands or millions of transistors, which
right.
creates your logic. So actually, before we go on, we should probably explain that basically this pursuit of smaller and smaller and smaller is to put more and more transistors. Transistors are basically the solid-state version of a switch.
That's right.
So how does a transistor work?
Well, so the old answer, and answers are changing as new transistor device architectures are now actually finally being implemented into production. But, you know, if we look at the historic case, it's been a simple silicon planar transistor. So in the silicon substrate, one has that particular silicon wafer doped. Let's say it's a predominantly P-doped silicon wafer. And you will then alternately dope two regions called the source and the drain. And then overlying the region of silicon between those two regions, you'll actually have a very thin oxide, which will act as an insulator. And on top of that, a gate where you can apply a voltage. And so by applying a voltage to that gate, you can basically change whether or not current can flow between the source
right.
and the drain. And so what you have now is a voltage-actuated switch
mm-hmm.
for current flow. And so by interconnecting one transistor to another, you can now form complex switching structures which will perform logic
yeah.
or memory storage or other particular
right. So if you think of on and off as a binary process, and we use binary numbers
right.
for this sort of thing, you can have it calculate all sorts of different things.
That's right.
And when you say dope, basically you take the base material, perhaps a silicon-based material, and add small amounts of some compound to make it change its conductivity, right?
Right. So you want to, well, you change essentially what the majority carrier type is in that particular substrate. So, you know, either it is enriched in holes or it's enriched in electrons.
Right.
And so then what happens when you apply a voltage to the gate is you can basically cause an inversion in what the majority carrier type is, and
mm-hmm.
that way you can actually allow current flow or not allow current flow depending on whether or not
right.
You've inverted the region near that surface.
Right, and when we think of normal conductors, you know, metal, copper, things like that, we think of electrons, but when we get to the semiconductor region, right, you have both modes, right?
Right. Well, and so, you know, today, I mean, you know, you have so-called CMOS or complementary metal oxide
uh-huh.
Semiconductors. And so you actually have both types of devices on the same type of
mm-hmm.
substrate at the same time. So there, you know, at one time people were doing so-called NMOS or PMOS, where
right.
literally it was all electron
yeah.
conduction or all really hole
right.
conduction.
Right, so N and P refer to
right.
holes versus, and is a hole simply an absence of an electron?
Right, that's the,
okay.
the easy way to think about it.
Right, which actually is not a problem because a lot of people will think of plus charge carriers even in a copper wire when in fact the real thing that's doing it is negative charge. But it's irrelevant, right? It's all about conductivity, right, and switching things over. So, okay, so...
But
right,
so back to your first question. Yeah. So part of the answer is, you know, making things smaller lets you switch them faster, okay, literally because the size of the distance between the source and the drain gets smaller. But, you know, more recently, that has not been true or as true as it has been historically because, of course, there are other speeds or times required that are also important. And in modern devices, it turns out the time it takes charge to transfer from one transistor to another over the so-called interconnect or the wire that connects mm-hmm. those two things together, that has also become now an appreciable amount of time relative to the time it takes to switch the transistor itself. And so these days, you're not getting continued scaling in terms of transistor or integrated circuit speed like you were in the days, you know, maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah, you cut the switch time in half, you double the speed. Now there's a lag of just literally the conduction across.
Yeah, you can actually become dominated by the time it takes to actually travel and interconnect.
All right.
But then I'll tell you real quick, the second issue is still packing more per area is still a big thing, right? Uh-huh. So, you know, everybody these days takes it for granted that now, come 6 months later, you can go buy that USB memory stick that now, you know,
much
today
cheaper,
you can go
yeah.
buy a 16 gig memory stick fairly inexpensively. 6 months from now or a year from now, you'll be buying the 32 gig one cheaply, and you can actually probably start to buy a 64 gig one, you know, at some reasonably expensive price.
Right.
And that, you know, that progression is enabled by just packing more transistors, mm-hmm. more memory storage devices into the same amount of real estate.
All right. All right. And I guess we got some callers.
Yeah.
Welcome
Can
to
I
the program.
Ask a question?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, thanks. This is wonderful. Thanks for, I just love that Atlanta's got, what, one physics show on now? So
All right.
Thank you.
That's good. You got to start somewhere.
So, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Many more. Okay, I mean, I've got a lot of questions, but I'll just ask one. I heard there's a famous or a notorious, I don't know what you, is he's a Japanese American physicist, and he's well known. I can't remember his name. It starts with A. But he was saying that we're going to see the end to Moore's law probably in the next 10 years, because there's going to be a point where we can't shrink these circuits down any smaller because of heat from the electrons themselves. So I was just wondering what's going on with that, and I would really like for him to be wrong. So,
as would we all.
Yeah, absolutely.
So certainly that that issue, and I think we're all familiar with it. So, you know, now, not too many years ago, if you put a very high-end laptop actually on your lap, you could easily get a burn.
Yeah. Scorch City, I've been
right, there. Absolutely. And I think we've all had some version of that. And why is that? It's because, of course, those microprocessors are dissipating in an extraordinarily large amount of heat that is indeed produced from essentially resistive heating in the device. And so that's a big concern, of course, because you can, you know, even if you don't put it on your lap, of course, you can actually melt a device down if you're not careful. So getting that heat out of the device or reducing the amount of heat that's actually produced in the device are both big issues, certainly in the industry. And you can imagine there are different ways to tackle that. One is to get more efficient heat removal built into the device. And people are thinking about what some would consider fairly exotic strategies. So literally putting in active cooling capacity, basically making, if you want to think about it, radiator type structures actually inside the silicon device. So you can imagine putting in liquid coolants.
Right. As opposed to outside now, where you put this big cooling block on your CPU.
Right. Right now, basically, the heat that's generated inside the device has to actually travel by conduction through the device itself to its external surface, where it's basically dissipated by some sort of fan or heat sink or combination of the two. Or some people who are, you know, building their modern high-end gaming systems are putting in liquid cooling on the external parts of the chip. But you can imagine actually integrating that into the chip as well. So that has certainly been in development and being worked on now for the last number of years. So that's one strategy. The other strategy, of course, is to actually just dissipate less heat. And how do you do that? Well, of course, there are many ways to potentially do that as well. One of them is by operating the devices at lower voltage, because the amount of heat you generate is both proportional to the amount of current that you're pumping through the device, but also the voltage at which you're actually pumping all that current. So there's obviously active work there as well. So being able to operate devices at lower and lower voltages. And certainly that's now the case with the most recent generation of Intel devices, for example. So some of you may follow the press in that area. They make announcements all the time about new processors. So lately you may have seen announcements from Intel about the so-called Ivy Bridge processor. That's actually quite an advancement in terms of silicon transistor technology, because it's the first time since the 50s where people have now started to make non-planar transistor devices and actually sell them to the mass market. So the new Ivy Bridge processors from Intel actually have the so-called Tri-Gate transistors, which now have essentially a silicon fin that sticks off the surface, which is where the transistor action is occurring, as opposed to just in the bulk silicon substrate itself. And that actually allows them, amongst many other things, to operate those devices at even lower voltages than they could a planar transistor device. And so those kind of things will also help you reduce the amount of heat you're generating in the device. So, you know, will there be fundamental limits? There is a fundamental limit somewhere. It's not clear to me that the heat dissipation will ultimately be the thing that limits us in terms of what we would think of as traditional silicon devices. But, you know, certainly it's possible. But, the short answer is that there are lots of very bright scientists and engineers working on those problems to do just what you suggested, which is to try and stave off the end of Moore's Law for as long as possible.
So good news.
Hopefully good news. I mean, certainly people are making steps in the right direction.
Yeah. All right. Great. Thanks for the question. Have we got another caller? Welcome to the program. Do you have a question or comment for us?
Hi, Pete. How are you?
Hey, how's it going?
I think high school students should be listening to this. They, I had two questions real quick.
Yeah, they were last week, by the way, actually, up in Gwinnett County. We were featured in their newspaper. But go ahead. What's your question?
My questions are, what countries will be manufacturing these new kinds of semiconductors? And also, do they produce any kind of hazardous waste in the production of them?
Yeah, that's actually a good question.
Okay, so let's take the first part first. So where are these kinds of things being made? And the short answer is they're being made all over the world. Certainly, you know, the U.S. historically has been one of, if not the world leader, in semiconductor technology. Obviously, the transistor itself was invented here in the United States. And, you know, basically all of the early work in integrated circuits occurred here in the United States. And so, the manufacturing outcome of that has been that the U.S. has been a leader in integrated circuit technology now essentially since the inception of the industry. Now, what's happened over time, of course, is that other countries have, progressed. And certainly there is a fairly large amount of production now that occurs both in Europe and also in Asia. But certainly there is also a fairly large amount of production that occurs here in the United States. Certainly one of the biggest producers here in the U.S. is Intel. So, you know, all of the processors that people buy that power their laptops and power their desktop computers that, you know, say Intel inside, they're made here in the United States. And so all of those manufacturing operations are in places like, you know, the Northwest. So in the Portland area where Intel has a large concentration of its operations. But, you know, those devices are packaged by Intel in places like Phoenix, Arizona. You know, you still have IBM, which is very active, which has fabs, you know, in various places around the country. You have what was Motorola, which is now Global Foundries, Freescale. Let me not confuse them. Names keep changing. So Freescale is what used to be the Motorola semiconductor product sector. They certainly have fabrication facilities scattered in places like Texas and also other parts of the country.
And is it fair to say that the stuff being manufactured in the United States is the high-end stuff? So innovation?
Certainly in terms of logic.
Yeah.
Logic. So if we broadly classify things either as logic or memory, certainly the U.S. is still the leader in logic. Intel and then their competitor, which at one time was called Advanced Micro Devices or AMD, many of you people may remember that name, they're now Global Foundries. So they are still the leaders in logic to a large extent internationally. On the memory side, the picture is a little bit more scattered. So you still have people here in the United States that are leaders in memory, but also certainly Asia has a very strong position now. As do country, you know, companies and countries in Europe. So,
right. So, by logic versus memory, logic is the chip that goes in your CPU, right on your motherboard, and memory is the thing that goes that little slot of several memory devices that tell you how much basically RAM you've got in your system.
Right, and these days it's a little harder to make that distinction because processors these days have lots of onboard memory packaged or built directly into them. So the lines get a little blurry, but the U.S. is still in a good position in terms of manufacturing capacity.
And you're doing what you can to keep it here.
And that's right. And so I think that's an important message actually that we all need to get to our politicians, even considering there's an election upcoming. That, you know, where does the U.S. make essentially a lot of its GDP? A lot of it is driven by technologically advanced manufacturing and technological products. And the big message there is that we need to make sure we don't fall behind in investment in research and development to maintain our edge in those high-tech areas. Okay. I think we're in danger of that. We're certainly not in as good a position there as we were, you know, even, you know, 10 or 20 years ago.
So what about hazardous wastes?
Then the second part of the question. So in terms of, you know, byproducts, actually, you know, if I compare sort of, you know, traditional chemical processing to a place like a semiconductor fab, the amount of waste materials produced by the semiconductor fab is actually relatively minor. They tend to be very extraordinarily clean operations, and they do an awfully good job of containing things and properly disposing of the waste that is manufactured. Probably the biggest issue in terms of an environmental impact of an actual manufacturing operation is that semiconductor fabs actually do utilize a lot of water. In cleaning all these things, water is still the most common solvent used in the process of silicon wafers. And so they tend to be located in places where water is relatively, abundant and inexpensive. But that water utilization issue is probably really the one that areas look at most in terms of semiconductor fab.
Okay. Great question. Thanks for the call. So I think the interesting issue is they spent a lot of time eliminating some of these nasty organic solvents. Trent walked out. So he's, do me a favor, pick up that phone. Now hang it up again. Oh, so we've got it. Trent, get in here. We've got a dial tone on. But in any case, they replaced a lot of some nasty organic solvents with more water-based solvents, right? That actually took a fair amount of research, right? Didn't they used to use some slightly nastier?
Yeah, certainly. Solvents? I mean, the chemicals of use have changed over time, and there's been a continuous drive to do things, you know, in a more environmentally friendly and also from a human health perspective, just safer for the workers' point of view. And so certainly the semiconductor fab today is a lot greener than one of, 30 years ago.
Right. So using lots of water is an issue, but it may have replaced maybe another issue.
I think it's not so much an issue that they contaminate the water. It's just, literally they need to have a high volume.
The physical amount. Right. Yeah. So. And then with regard to these new transistors in the Ivy Bridge, because I've got a computer that uses that chipset, what you notice now is they will actually... You won't have as big a fan or big aluminum fan.
That's
you had
right.
these monster CPU fans from years ago. They're actually, shipping them with smaller fans because the heat dissipation isn't as bad.
That's right, yeah. So you'll see in the latest generation of laptop chipsets that come out of that that they will operate much cooler.
Yeah.
You won't feel the same amount of heat dissipation that you felt maybe just a generation or two ago in laptops.
Okay. All right, so let's take a quick break, and when we come back, let's talk about what's coming down the pipe in terms of new methods for building the next generation of these chips. We'll be right back on Inside the Black Box. Science, only funnier.
Whether it's rock, blues, electronic, hip-hop, R&B, or reggae, they all have one thing in common. You can hear them all during the Rock, Rhythm, and Wolves Sound Block, Monday through Thursday from 1 to 6 p.m. and 1 to 5 p.m. on Fridays, only at WREK Atlanta 91.1 FM.
For over 35 years, the Stonehenge Show on WREK 91.1 FM has brought the very finest underground classic rock, to lovers of the music you never hear on commercial radio. Stonehenge begins at 8 p.m. every Friday night with the classic rock album of the week. Then we kick off the weekend in fine style with more than 3 hours of the finest rock music in the cosmos. Stonehenge, putting the class back into classic rock.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking about new developments in the semiconductor industry with Cliff Henderson, semiconductor guru and all-around snappy dresser. That's what I'm going with today. So we had a question during the break where somebody phoned in about optical switching, replacing this sort of standard whole electron conduction switching thing with photons instead.
Right, so I talked to the caller for a second, and the basic question was, you know, do optical devices and the use of photons in place of electrons get you around Moore's law in some sense? And certainly people have and continue to look at sort of all optical-based devices. So there's an entire field of silicon photonics and people looking at making essentially the optical analog of electrical, you know, transistor-based integrated circuits. You know, is it possible? Certainly there may be something there. You know, it's a radical switch away from the way that the entire infrastructure works now. And that itself imposes some hurdle. You know, there's a multi-billion-dollar, multi-trillion-dollar industry that is, you know, that is basically geared up to make electrical devices. So, you know, obviously there's a lot of impetus to continue to extend that as far as possible. But certainly there may be some possibility there. The general challenge is that it's difficult in the size scales that we are currently working with electrons at to find equivalent ways to work with photons. So, you know, to make the analogous simple optical switch in, you know, the amount of real estate that we're making a silicon switch, no one has a good design that I know of to do that kind of thing. And so, you know, you can imagine that you also need then emitters for light and detectors for photons built into the device, whereas, you know, by comparison, actually, the traditional electrical transistor is actually quite simple. You know, it's all current flow. So you don't have to, you know, transform a signal at any location. And so to do an all optical device where you never have to transfer photon information into electrons and back and forth, that's not yet so feasible.
But we do lots of optical stuff where you like to use the light for spectroscopy or sensing or things like that, right?
Well, really even for data transmission, right? Obviously, we're using optical fiber networks extensively these days to transfer data. But at the ends of those networks, obviously, we are translating much of that information into electrons, or we're generating those optical signals from an electronic device. So it's that interfacing that makes it tough right now. If you could really develop an all optical device, there would certainly be, you know, some great interest in that. Right now, you know, we're fairly far away from doing anything equivalent to that. So so we're gonna have to still pump electrons around for quite a while longer.
Okay, and then one of our other callers asked about your comment about we need to make sure and have appropriate capital and funding available for the fundamental research to push this semiconductor industry. So that we keep, you know, sort of an edge, an innovation edge. And I've always claimed that, you know, people that say, well, okay, we've moved to a service economy. I don't think we've ever moved to a service economy. What keeps the United States going is innovation. So, you know, once it becomes old hat and it's old technology, well, then it gets shipped off somewhere else and the labor costs make a difference. But when it's new stuff, it's done here. So I guess they asked, you know, how what was it, Trent? How should we change the nature of education?
I was like, what kind of curriculum would you be giving in, like, you know, elementary schools and middle schools? Yeah. And, like, what kind of math would you teach sixth graders? Yeah. Or what kind of classes to generate interest?
And is it more the wow factor to get them excited about doing this than it is the actual math?
Yeah, I think ultimately the kinds of things we're teaching students these days is actually the right kind of thing. So I think, you know, we don't have to do a dramatic transformation of the math or the science curriculum. You know, the basic skills and knowledge needed, you know, really hasn't changed. It's more of getting enough students interested in pursuing science and engineering careers. We really need the human capital, right? The people who are really interested in it, who pursue those degrees at the college level, who can then go on and make those innovations and populate all those companies to actually make the devices and make those advances.
So what we need is to expose elementary kids to the semiconductor equivalent of a guy jumping out of a capsule 24 miles in the
sky. Yeah, I would agree with you. You know, I mean, unfortunately, you know, today people have just become blasé about the amount of technology they interact with on a
daily
basis.
But it's there. I mean, your smartphone is a miracle of technology.
Yeah,
and it's due to the semiconductor industry.
So if you walked back 50 years and handed someone a modern phone, right, they would very quickly convince themselves that you were from Star Trek.
Absolutely. In fact, it basically was the tricorder and the communicator wrapped into one.
I mean, if you think about the size scale and the precision at which we're actually manufacturing devices these days, it's absolutely, you know, sort of mind-blowing. I mean, so, you know, to give people a feel for it, you know, the human hair is about 50 microns in diameter. So
if you have them.
If you have them. I understand
on
you're follically challenged, but you know, you still have some appreciation for it. So about 50 microns. So that's you know, that's a fairly small object. So we're so that in terms of nanometers is about 50,000 nanometers. And so by comparison, you're able to buy now in the latest Ivy Bridge transistors things that are 22 nanometers in size. So we're manufacturing with extraordinarily high precision things that are 22 nanometers in size, and compare that to 50,000 nanometers for your human hair. So we're basically manufacturing things where we're doing control of the structure down to atomic levels, essentially. We can start to count atoms, and individual numbers of atoms become important in the manufacturing operation. You know, that would be unthinkable 50 years ago.
Right.
And people would just assume that there was no way you could make something like that, you know, just a few decades ago.
Right.
But so how is it possible? It's because, again, we've educated and trained scientists and engineers who've been awfully clever over the last 50 years who've made all those advancements possible.
Yeah, and literally it's been thousands of individual engineering and science developments that have contributed
Absolutely.
To this.
Absolutely. It's, you know, it's one of these funny technologies that essentially the generation of the next technology enables continued advancement to build the next generation.
Yeah.
So, you know, 50 years ago, they could have not gotten in one jump to where we are today. It's been a natural progression that's had to occur over the last five decades.
So before we wrap up here, can we at least mention one new thing that I know you're involved in? We're involved in this with you as well, that, you know, you do these patterns and we're kind of limited to how small we can make these patterns.
Yeah, there's no shortage of challenges today. So a caller earlier mentioned, you know, heat generation as being the ultimate limiter. There are many things that could potentially be the ultimate roadblock for continuing to advance semiconductors. And ultimately, one of them, which is quite scary, is actually just cost.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are cases in any technology where it's not that you may not be able to do something technologically, but you may not be able to do it at a cost scale that actually people want to buy.
Yes.
So the classic example is in airplanes, actually, right? So we'll take this in a different direction for a second. So look at the Concorde. You know, so you can certainly do supersonic flight. We even did supersonic flight for passenger aircraft, but you notice that there are no Concordes flying anymore.
Right.
And why? It's not because we can't do it. It's because people don't want to pay the cost to do it. And the same thing could happen in semiconductors. It's not that we may not be able to manufacture smaller devices and continue the scaling. But the problem may be that the cost required to do that may become so prohibitively expensive that you don't want to go pay, instead of $500 for your cell phone, you don't want to go pay $2,000 for your cell phone.
I don't even want to pay $500 for mine. So I get the 2-year contract and get it for $99.
So what are some of those challenges that are driving that cost scaling? You know, so even before we run into an absolute technological roadblock and can't do it, there may be cases where we just can't do it cheaply enough. And that's what we're kind of facing right now in patterning. So right now with the current 193 nanometer wavelength light that we use to do the patterning currently.
Right. And the wavelength of the light determines how small you can project these patterns.
Absolutely. The resolution, the minimum printable feature size, is scaling directly with that wavelength. So we've continued to decrease that wavelength far down into the ultraviolet. And today we're basically now at the point where, with the best tools we have available at that 193 nanometer wavelength using immersion lithography, We're producing devices that are basically at the resolution limit of those tools. And the problem we have is that there is no next generation of tools waiting in the wings that are ready to make an even smaller device generation.
And when you say immersion lithography, you're using an old trick that we remember from high school biology, but a lot of our students don't. In order to make that objective lens magnify just a little bit more, we used to use it to see bacteria when I was in high school. You put a little drop of oil, forms a little meniscus, and you get a magnification effect from that immersion in liquid. And they're pulling a similar trick to make these Ivy Bridge Intel processors.
That's right. They literally put a layer of water between their, you know.
So there's one of your
multi-million-dollar
clever engineering tricks. Yeah.
And the wafer. That's right. So, but, you know, the problem is that, again, they've now kind of run the gamut of that technology as well. So now those Ivy Bridge transistors you're buying, they're basically, they contain features that are essentially at the resolution limit of the tools. And so the big question, probably the first one to hit, is now to continue to advance to that next node on the technology progression to make the next smaller transistors, how do you print those features? And so the short-term solution is one that actually will increase cost to people in terms of the final chip cost. And that is now we will actually take what would be the next smaller pattern and we'll actually divide it into two patterns and we'll print twice on the same layer to make the next generation of smaller devices. And that doesn't seem like a lot, but it turns out now that now if I have to do that lithography step twice, that means whatever it costs, now it costs me that twice for each layer
and
that I have to do.
You've
got to
do that hundreds of times.
And it turns out that lithography patterning step is the most expensive step in the entire process. So that translates into real cost. So what the technology that you mentioned that actually you and I are collaborating on is to look at ways to use block copolymers of all things to try
so
and
polymer
subdivide.
With, you know, one polymer like polystyrene that you make plastic model airplanes out of and polymethylmethacrylate that you make plexiglass out of. That's just an example of it.
Right.
And you make them long enough, they don't like each other. And
they
phase separate into a row of polystyrene and polymethylmethacrylate and make nice little rows under the right conditions.
That's right. So we basically want to try and utilize the natural phase separation that occurs, just much like oil and water want to phase separate if you try and mix those. Now imagine doing that where you actually couple covalently those two materials together so they can only separate at length scales, which are essentially their molecular size.
Right.
We want to use that phase separation to try and subdivide the smallest patterns we can get currently lithographically into even smaller patterns to make the future devices.
And this will this be better with regard to cost as compared to the double patterning?
It would be significantly cheaper than having to repeat the very expensive lithographic patterning step multiple times.
And I'll leave you with this caveat. If we can get it to work reliably and systematically.
That's right.
Yeah, isn't that the tough part?
Well, so there are interesting challenges both on the polymer science and the polymer chemistry and the
We argued about this for 4 hours last night. In fact, we'll be talking about it later today.
Yeah, so it's a very rich area to work in.
All right, so let's see if we can summarize all this stuff. I don't think I can, but even the electronics field sees the importance of replacing really expensive metals like indium with things that may be cheaper. So that's an active area of research for them. Graphene may be a good candidate for that sort of thing. This multi-step patterning, right, the sort of these four patterning steps reproduced over and over again, really hasn't changed much since the beginning of the semiconductor industry. But it's really some clever ways that you do it with a lot of neat engineering to make it smaller and smaller and smaller and more reliable. Photons won't necessarily help us. If we can get a switching device, right, to actually do this sort of thing, that may actually do it. And actually, we mentioned the Nobel Prize in chemistry, what was it, last week, for quantum computing, where you actually use individual quantum states of individual molecules, might help us out. We're going to hopefully have Ken Brown from the chemistry department here at Georgia Tech talking about that thing in a few weeks as well. But right now, we're doing pretty well with the way we do semiconductor stuff. And the limit so much isn't that we can't do it. It's that sometimes it's more expensive to do it with this double patterning, this double printing sort of approach. And maybe these weird phase separated block copolymers might be the answer to that thing. For those of you that are old enough to remember Jell-O 1-2-3, Trent, you remember Jell-O 1-2-3? This thing phase separated into three different phases. You had like a chiffon cream layer and then a pudding layer and then a Jell-O layer.
Instant dessert. Yeah.
Well, that's basically what we're doing, but at a molecular level. Yeah. And the good news is that of all the things that may sort of stop this progression, heat may not be it because they're making some good progress on that. And the latest Intel Ivy Bridge chipset is a good example of heat management by that sort of things. And for all the issues we have with the chemicals being used to process this very chemically oriented process, right? Not necessarily as much as electrical engineering. They're the guys that design the chips, but actually the materials issues with making them is a much more chemistry and chemical engineering focused thing, that with all the issues they have with needing water, relatively clean and green, certainly compared to refineries and chemical plants and things like that.
Right.
Okay.
So yeah, can I leave one last plug for chemical engineering?
You certainly may.
So you mentioned it. I think, this is, a lot of people actually have a poor understanding of what chemical engineers do. They automatically sort of, as you mentioned, assume, petroleum refining.
I thought we sit
things.
On the radio and yak.
That may be true, too. But, I think semiconductors is a classic example of what chemical engineers do, right? They take very low value or lower value starting materials and they use chemical transformations
right.
to make very
sand,
high value right. products. And you're right. So, semiconductors is a classic case. So literally the starting material that starts the entire process is sand. That is the original place where we get the silicon from. And we go through a whole sequence of chemical transformations to make a computer chip. And so you take something which is essentially free and very abundant, and we make things that cost, thousands of dollars per gram, essentially, if we wanted to do it on a weight basis in the final devices.
All right, so I can sum that up as chemical engineering, feel the sensation.
Absolutely.
Okay, Cliff, thanks so much for being on the program. And if you've got a question or comment about this program or a suggestion for a future show, by all means, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. Trent Altman is our chief engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Bill and Mary Hunt. And we are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Please join us next week for Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.